morning. Good to see everybody. I think everybody's heard of C.S. Lewis. So he's a favorite author among many Christians. And I'm losing my voice already. I'm not even getting started. I'm way past my expiration date here. All right, so C.S. Lewis is, as you know, a favorite author among many Christians, and he had a circle of friends who were quite impressive as well, like J.R. Tolkien and another one named Dorothy Sayers. Sayers is probably best known for a book she wrote back in the 1940s titled Creed or Chaos. The first chapter is very powerful, and we often refer to it around here and read from it. In it, she colorfully explains that the birth, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus is the greatest drama that has ever been staged. You've heard us talk about this. And whether you believe it is true or not, you certainly cannot call it dull. Just a royal way to punch that. And she was at the time, of course, addressing the problem of churches, mostly in England, treating the faith in a ho-hum fashion, which left everyone, Christians and non-Christians alike, viewing not just the gospel as boring, dull, and uninteresting, but even Jesus himself. And she's irritated by this, and she goes after that with great force, explaining how exciting the whole story of redemption is, and how sincerely tragic it is that Jesus had been turned into some sort of milquetoast sissy. She blames insipid clergymen and pious old ladies for turning the Lion of Judah into some sort of tame and domesticated pussycat. And the book was written over 70 years ago, but it still burns fiery hot when you read it. And she was a feisty writer. And then she makes this point. This great drama that God became man, lived among us, performed miracles, proclaimed the kingdom of God, was crucified, and rose again, was all played out on a very, very carefully laid out stage, a specific historical setting involving real people, real places, real events, all of which served to highlight and enrich the drama, making it real and giving it depth. God did not suffer and die and rise in some remote and mythical place, in some remote and mythical period of prehistory. Referring, of course, to the gods of mythology and folklore, fantasy, that sort of thing. So today is Palm Sunday. It is a time of the year when we turn our attention to the events of Holy Week, real events, from Christ's triumphal entry into Jerusalem to his arrest, trial, crucifixion, and then, of course, 3 days later, his resurrection. Holy Week is the climax of this greatest drama that has ever been staged. And so with all that in mind, I thought it would be good to familiarize ourselves again with this great story and with the stage itself. Last Sunday, we covered some of the background material, the historical and cultural setting, the stage, if you will. We began with this timeline that you see here, looking at how the 33-year period of Jesus fits in with other people and other events at that time. We also familiarized ourselves with the layout of the land as seen by this map of first century Palestine. You may remember that Jesus spent most of his time in the north in Galilee. And part of what we covered last Sunday included a very basic timeline of his life. We start with the beginnings, and this we would include his birth, childhood, his baptism, and time of testing in the wilderness. And then we have his 3-year public ministry. And then the final days in Jerusalem, often referred to as Holy Week or the Week of Passion. And this morning we're going to fill that outline in a little bit more, but even in this, all we can do is just highlight some of the main events. However, I do want to take more time to with the final 8 days, Holy Week, starting with this triumphal entry into Jerusalem on Sunday and all that transpires between then and his resurrection on the following Sunday. And hopefully this will set things up for our Good Friday service later this week and then Easter itself next Sunday. And I'm going to assume that most folks here will be quite familiar with most of the material that will be shared today. These are the sorts of things that you've learned throughout the years, starting as a child in Sunday school. They are, of course, the stuff that makes up the four Gospels. Hopefully everyone is reading through those on a regular basis. And today isn't the first time I've presented this material. But nonetheless, it's all quite foundational, very important, foundational to our faith, and it's all very rich. And so it's quite appropriate to revisit it from time to time, especially this time of the year. And there might be a few facts pertaining to background information that perhaps will be new to some. So before I dive into it, I want to just circle back real quick here and clarify something I said last Sunday about Herod the Great. I mentioned that he was a Jew, and this may have been one of the reasons he was appointed by the Romans to rule over the Jews. And one of our members questioned whether he was actually Jewish, and so here is the scoop. He was not a Jew by blood. Both of his parents were Idumeans, a people who lived in a region south of Judea and were once known as the Edomites. However, several generations before Herod, his ancestors had converted to Judaism, as did virtually all Idumeans, because they were actually forced to convert by the king at that time. But from that point on, Idumeans lived like all other Jews. They practiced circumcision, regarded Jerusalem as their holy city, worshipped in the temple, embraced the law of Moses, observed the Sabbath, all the holy days, and so forth. And Herod the Great was no exception, and he considered himself a bona fide Jew. Others, however, regarded him as only a half-Jew, and this may help explain why many resisted him as king. And by the way, the Idumeans were descendants of Esau, the brother of Isaac, and so they and the Jews were blood relatives. So there you have it, and all of that will be on the test, so I'm hoping that you were taking notes during that. Sure. Everybody, whenever I say, listen, we just need to get conditioned here. Whenever I say that will be on the test, everyone should say, yes, that can't wait. So let's try it again. And that will be on the test. There we go. No, that's a special test. That's a test on the Trinity and the divinity of Christ. That's just for, yeah, right. Yeah. You've been here long enough to know how this works. Okay. Moving on to a survey of Christ's earthly ministry. So last week I shared a popular and easy to remember way of outlining those 3 years. It simply involves dividing that up into 3 periods, each consisting of around 1 year each. The first could be called the year of obscurity. It is called that partly because the records of it, which we possess, are scantly, and partly because during it, Jesus seems to have been only slowly emerging into public notice. Most of Christ's activity during this time of approximately 8 months seems to have been spent in Judea. The second period is the year of public favor, during which his fame as a teacher and healer extended far and wide. Most of his activity during this period, lasting about 15 months, was confined to Galilee. And then the third period was the year of opposition. By this time, Christ's enemies had multiplied, and eventually plans were being made to secure his execution. And the first part of this took place in Galilee, and the last part in other parts of Palestine, and finally, of course, in Jerusalem itself. So we're going to fill that in a little bit more, and keep in mind that the sequence of events I'll be proposing might not be 100% precise. Any attempt to harmonize the four Gospels will face certain challenges, especially to chronology. Biographies of the ancient world were more concerned about what happened and what that meant, rather than mapping out an exact timeline. However, we'll certainly be able to paint a general picture of how things transpired in relation to each other, and that's mostly what we're interested in. So we'll start with the year of obscurity. Up until the time of his baptism, Jesus had been in the village of Nazareth, probably working for his father, who was known as the town's carpenter. It was customary for sons to continue in the trade they had learned from their fathers. And so even during his teens and 20s, Jesus was perhaps a woodworker of sorts. However, the word used in the Gospels for carpentry can also refer to a builder. And since homes back then were constructed out of blocks that were made out of mud or stones, it could be that Jesus is more like a brick mason or stonemason. And so then those of us in this church, like Rob Schwartz and myself, who were once in that trade, would have a special connection with the Lord that the rest of you would not have. Now, I've mentioned this a couple times over the years, and I never get tired of bringing it up. All right, sometime around 27 AD, at least 30, at 27 AD, when he's 30 years old, Jesus joined the crowds that were streaming into the Jordan wilderness to be baptized by John. Immediately after his baptism, he was led into the wilderness to be tested by the devil, a period of 40 days in which he also fasted. There is some discussion whether 40 days refers to 40 actual days or whether 40 is symbolic for a long extended period of time. Whatever the case, we know that at the end of it, he was on the verge of starving and required food and was quite vulnerable to various temptations. Matthew and Mark mention three such trials or temptations, but we should not regard that as a complete list, but more like examples. And likewise, we should not think that the only temptations that Jesus ever faced took place during that 40-day period in the wilderness. Now, here is why this time of testing is so important. Jesus was deeply aware of his mission and power to accomplish it, and each of those tests that are recorded touch on the methods he would use to accomplish that mission. Would he use his power to perform miracles to preserve himself, as in turning stones to bread? Would he use miracles to impress others? Would he draw crowds by astonishing them with a spectacular, like jumping off the top of the temple? Hey, everybody, watch this. Even the nature of the kingdom he came to establish, would it be a kingdom like those of this world, with wealth, fame, power, possessions? If the appeal of that itself is not enticing, how about being able to obtain it in an easy way? Avoid the pain and death of the cross. Simply bow down and give your allegiance to the devil. That would be a pretty appealing. Maybe not serving the devil, but at least avoiding the cross. And so the public ministry of Jesus, which is about to be launched, is opened against this background of tremendous struggle and concludes with a resolute rejection on his part of any and all methods that would compromise the eternal plan. So this is a very significant time here. After this, Jesus ascends from the valley of the Jordan to the higher country of Galilee. There, as you will remember, in the village of Cana, he performed the first of many miracles, turning water into wine at a wedding. Among Christ's early followers were some who had formerly been disciples of John the Baptist. Among them would be two pairs of brothers, Andrew and Peter, along with Philip and Nathanael. They were the first to be his disciples. Others joined up with Jesus later on. All 12 were from Galilee except for Judas Iscariot, who was from the southern part of Judea. After a brief stay at the nearby town of Capernaum, he headed south to Jerusalem for the Passover. He spent some time there in Judea, but when he learned that he was gaining more followers than John the Baptist, he decided to return to Galilee. And we're not really sure why, but it could be that he did not want his popularity to spread just yet, at least here in Judea. On his way back to Galilee, he had to go through Samaria, and there in Samaria, he interacts with the woman at the well, the woman who had five husbands. You'll know the story. And then she goes on and tells the village that the Messiah had come, and as a result, a number of Samaritans came to hear him and came to believe in him. And toward the end of this eight-month period, the year of obscurity, the Gospels tell us that news about him started to spread throughout the whole region. So this brings us to the year of public favor. And this could be characterized by the increase of popularity, even excitement about Jesus, especially in Galilee. Capernaum, a town in the northern part of Galilee, becomes the primary focus during this time. Here, Jesus heals a number of people, the son of a Roman centurion, Peter's mother-in-law, a demon-possessed man, and many others who were afflicted with various diseases. And the number of his followers increased rapidly, and the gospel writers refer to them as crowds and multitudes. Excuse me. During the second year of his ministry, Jesus went to Jerusalem again to participate in the celebration of a feast and came into conflict with Jewish leaders when he healed a lame man on the Sabbath day. And soon after, he returned to Galilee, where his popularity continued to grow. It is during this period that Jesus calms the storm, raises the daughter of Jairus back to life, and sends out the 12 to preach and heal. Besides performing works of healing, Jesus also preached and taught his followers. A number of these teachings during this year public favor have been preserved, like the Sermon on the Mount and the collection of parables found in Matthew 13 and so on, as just a couple examples. And now for the year of opposition. Though certainly there were occasions when Jesus enjoyed the favor of the people during this third year of his ministry, by and large that favor was decreasing and opposition to him was increasing, and it was increasing a lot. What had previously been only occasional displays of hostility by the teachers of the law and Pharisees against Jesus, this had now escalated significantly in both number and in intensity. The common people had obviously noticed a profound difference between Jesus and their religious leaders, and as to be expected, such leaders were not only envious of his success, but also felt very threatened by that success as well. And given this great teacher and healer, who would ever listen to them anymore, who would revere them? But even among the general population, many were starting to drift away. Some of this was because Jesus was not fulfilling the expectations of what they were looking for in a Messiah. We've talked about this in the past. And some of it was because of the demands he laid upon those who desired to be his followers. The whole message of dying to oneself was too much, and so many walked away. Please stand by. I think it's guardrail weekend at the base. All right. Toward the end of his journeys in Judea, Jesus was in a small village near Jerusalem named Bethany, where he raised Lazarus to life. The miracle was so astounding that certain members of the Sanhedrin, when they heard about it, they were deeply troubled. And under the leadership of Caiaphas, the high priest, they concluded that the influence of Jesus had to end, and there was only one way to do that, secure his death. So the miracle there of raising Lazarus from the dead was very instrumental, moving him in that direction. All right, so the year of opposition began while Jesus was still in Galilee, and it continued with his journey to Judea and then concludes in his final week there in Jerusalem. Some of the events during this period include the feeding of the 5,000, walking on water, healing of a man born blind, blessing the little children, his interaction with the young rich man, his interaction with Zacchaeus, the healing of a blind man, Bartimaeus, the healing of the 10 lepers, and the transfiguration. And the period ends, of course, with the opposition comes to a head, the final days in Jerusalem. And so with that overview of his three-year ministry, let's now turn our attention to those final days, Holy Week. And this is an eight-day period that runs from Sunday as he enters the city of Jerusalem to the next Sunday when he rises from the dead. And this, too, is a difficult period in which to arrange the events in precise order, and so again, what I'll be laying out might not be at all times 100% accurate, but it should be close. So we begin with Sunday, Palm Sunday, when Jesus approaches Jerusalem and begins to enter it. The event is festive, jubilant, impressive, striking. The royal yet humble entry of Jesus, with the crowd spreading their cloaks on the road and before him, along with all the palm branches, shouting Hosea to the Son of David, as Jesus rode down the streets on a simple donkey, would have made, of course, a profound impression on all who saw it. The event is colored with both majesty and humility. And given the worship and acclamations of the multitudes, it would be the furthest thing from anyone's imagination that within just a few days, this same Jesus, hailed as Israel's long-awaited king, would be in this same city, convicted as a blasphemer by the Jewish leaders and crucified by the Romans for subversion. As he gets closer to the entrance of the city, the mood of Jesus takes a drastic change from joy to deep sorrow, and Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. And in his weeping, he prophesies Jerusalem's downfall and destruction. On Monday, what happened to my... This is aggravating. I had all this fixed. Okay, we have to stop. I got to go to my office, come back. It's not consistent. Josh, did you tamper with these? No? Just say yes so I could yell at you anyway about it. On Monday, Jesus enters the temple area and clears out all who are buying and selling, overturning the tables of the money changers and creating quite a scene. This is sometimes referred to as the purification of the temple. The action here, as D.A. Carson puts it, is an act of self-disclosure. That might be a good way to kind of think about this. He is claiming, rather exercising his authority over the high, over the holy place. The ancient prophet spoke of the Lord coming into his temple, and the purification of the temple and of Jerusalem was part of this Jewish expectation. And so Jesus is fulfilling that and driving out the merchants and money changers. And the sounds that filled its courts were not that of prayers and worship, as you know, but rather the busy hum of trade mingled with the bleating and cooing of animals and birds and the jingling of coins and back and forth bartering between buyers and sellers. Yet, this profaning of the temple was but a picture of what had happened to Israel as a whole. The corruption within God's temple was simply a symptom of a larger problem, the corruption of God's people, within God's people. And the Jews had embraced a superstitious approach to God, placing their faith in rituals and temples and man-made traditions and outward forms of worship. They did not love God nor care about his ways. They did not strive to live pure lives before him. They were not all that concerned about mercy, justice, and righteousness. And if they had truly longed for God and his ways, the teachings of Jesus would have resonated with them. And this driving out of the merchants, money changers, pigeons, sparrows, sheep, trinkets, and all the rest is symbolic not only of the cleansing that needed to take place in Israel itself, but also of the cleansing that was about to take place, namely the destruction of the temple and the fall of Jerusalem that Jesus prophesied about, wept about the previous day, which of course was fulfilled in 70 AD. And this itself was symbolic of something even more, that God was putting an end to the old covenant and its sacrificial system and temple worship, and this would no longer be the way for people to come to him. Instead, there was a new covenant, a new sacrifice, a new way to God, his son Jesus. And as we know from John's gospel, Jesus himself is now the temple, the place, if you will, where one meets God. But the scene here on Monday becomes for the religious leaders the last straw. They are now more resolute than ever to eliminate Jesus and do it quickly and to do it finally. And closely associated with the purification of the temple is the cursing of the fig tree, which takes place on the same day. And this involves also much symbolism. The fig tree represents Israel, which had all the external appearance of flourishing religiously, but had not produced the fruit of righteousness. And the destruction of the tree was likewise an illustration of God's judgment. Moving on to Tuesday, while teaching in the temple courts, Jesus warns his audience about the hypocrisy of the teachers of the law and the Pharisees. He predicts yet again the destruction of the temple and its coming, and his coming in glory as the Son of Man. He shares a number of parables, and his authority is questioned by religious leaders. Along with this, a number of attempts are made to trap him with certain questions like, what about paying taxes to Caesar? And what about the widow who marries her husband's brother? And so on and so on and so on. And who will be her husband in the resurrection? And those sorts of things. And in response, Jesus directs certain questions to them, questions they do not want to answer. And so Tuesday, you might think of it as a day that is marked by a lot of controversy. We can't say with absolute certainty, but it looks as though Wednesday is the day when a number of religious leaders, along with Caiaphas, actually form their plan to arrest Jesus and have him killed. And it also appears that it was on Wednesday when Jesus is in Bethany dining at the home of a man named Simon the leper. Bethany is just a couple miles outside Jerusalem, so this would be like maybe a 40-minute walk for most people. And you know the story. A woman comes into Simon's house with an expensive jar of perfume. She breaks the jar, pours the perfume out on the feet of Jesus, and Judas rebukes her and complains about how this is a big waste, saying that the perfume could have been sold and the money given to the poor. And Jesus actually honors the woman, saying that what she has done is a wonderful thing and that her perfume served as a preparation for his burial and that for that no cost is too great. Judas, feeling a bit embarrassed by this and also motivated by no small measure of greed, takes the opportunity later in the day to meet with the chief priests and certain teachers of the law and agrees to participate in their plot for a price to betray Jesus, 30 pieces of silver. Thursday, of course, is the day Jesus meets with his disciples for what has become known the Last Supper. This is referred to in Matthew as the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so the Last Supper itself was closely tied to the Passover meal. Before sitting down for the meal, Jesus washes the feet of his disciples as an example of humility and service. And this is why Thursday is often called Maundy Thursday. Maundy coming from a Latin word meaning commandment, referring here to Christ's command to wash the feet of others. In the meal itself, Jesus refers to the bread as his body, the wine as his blood, and in this he establishes the practice that the early church called the Lord's Supper. And Jesus was ensuring that the memory of his ministry and his sacrifice on the cross would not be forgotten. Later in the meal itself, Jesus announces that a betrayer was in the room with them. Judas leaves, meets up with the members of the Sanhedrin. The plot to seize Jesus away from the crowds is now underway. The Last Supper takes place in what is referred to as a large upper room. And when they finished, everyone heads to the place called Gethsemane. And sometime during that walk, Jesus predicts his arrest, death, and even resurrection. And he also tells them that they will abandon him during his hour of need. And Peter, of course, interjects himself, claiming that he would never deny his master, to which Jesus predicts that before a rooster crows three times, that he will deny him indeed. At Gethsemane, Jesus calls in his disciples to pray, and then he goes off by himself so as to pray alone. In this prayer, he wrestles with God, wrestles with the two options that lie before him: save himself from the pain of the crucifixion and death itself, or fulfill the plan of offering his life as an atonement for the sins of the world. The words, "If it is possible, may this cup be taken from me," are quite telling. He prays in great anguish, as you know, to the point that his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. A large crowd armed with swords and clubs invades the garden looking for Jesus. Judas identifies Jesus for them with a kiss, and upon that, members of the mob arrest him. These are not Roman soldiers, rather they are temple guards, temple soldiers who have been sent by the high priest himself. Peter reacts with the sword cutting off the ear of one of such members of the mob, and Judas rebukes Peter and heals the man's ear. Jesus is then hauled off to the Sanhedrin, a council of 70 religious leaders who are waiting for him to arrive. Peter follows but hangs back. He's eager to know what is going on, and so he tries to mingle in with the others, who are also hanging out in the courtyard outside the house of Caiaphas, but he is discovered, and upon questioning, Peter cowers back and denies ever knowing Jesus. A few words about the Sanhedrin would be in order here. The Sanhedrin, also known as the Great Council, was again made up of 70 leaders, 70 religious Jewish rulers, which included three kinds of members: high priests, the current high priest and any former high priests who may still be alive; the elders, these would be tribal and family representatives, respected leaders from the Jewish community; and also scribes, known as the teachers of the law, rabbis. And these teachers were the legal experts of the day, scholars of the Old Testament, if you will, and of the interpretations of the Old Testament passed down through tradition. And most of these rabbis were Pharisees, but not all. Now, the authority of the Sanhedrin itself was basically dependent on who from Rome was governing at the time. Under Pilate, the Sanhedrin had a lot of power. It was actually the chief governing body in the land, regulating both religious and civil matters within the limits set down by Rome. It had police force under its command and could make arrests, try those accused, and mete out punishments. They could not, however, as we've talked about before, carry out capital punishment on their own. For something like that, they had to take the matter to the procurator, the Roman governor, and for the most part, he would simply rubber stamp anything that they might bring to him. When in session, the members of the Sanhedrin, they would meet in a semicircle so that they could all see each other. At the end stood a clerk who would record votes of acquittal and votes of condemnation. A verdict of condemnation required 2/3 majority. The high priest presided over the meeting. Before such a council, Jesus was tried and condemned. Witnesses were brought in to testify against him, but their testimonies, as you know, contradicted each other. Nonetheless, they proceeded on the charge that Jesus threatened to destroy the temple. And it appears that the trial went on all through the night, even until daybreak the next morning. In the end, Jesus was forced to declare whether he believed himself to be the Son of God or not. He affirmed this claim, which then resulted in the charge of blasphemy. The trial itself, as you read it from the gospel accounts, clearly demonstrates the intense desire of the Jewish authorities to condemn him. And here we have a group of desperate men who, while trying to keep a show of propriety and at least some image of legality, take what can only be regarded as an extreme and radical measure, sentencing someone to die who has harmed no one. The only people he has harmed would be the religious leaders, and he only harmed them by harming their pride. He's harmed no one. Even the charge of threatening to destroy the temple is really quite telling. To this great council, we would like to ask, do you believe he has the ability to tear down the temple? Do you really feel threatened by that? If not, why must he be executed? But if you do believe it, well, wouldn't that be an admission that God's power is at work in him after all? Some of the members of the Sanhedrin were supporters of Jesus, and perhaps points like that had been raised. Found guilty of blasphemy, Jesus is sentenced to death. This is an offense punishable by death under Jewish law. Members of the Sanhedrin spit in his face, strike him, mock him, prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you? And the soldiers belonging to the Sanhedrin then take him and beat him. So very early the next morning on Friday, two things happen, perhaps even simultaneously. Judas, filled with remorse and regret, hangs himself. And the other is this: Jesus is taken to Pontius Pilate. The Sanhedrin has two challenges to overcome here. First, they do not have the authority under Rome to carry out the death penalty. And secondly, Rome could care less about a conviction of blasphemy. And they know that this will be a tough sell for them. And as to be expected, Pilate does not seem interested in handling the matter, but he is forced into it when members of the Sanhedrin tell him that Jesus is leading a rebellion by claiming to be a king. Pilate still isn't convinced that Jesus poses any threat, and so upon learning that he is a Galilean, he sends Jesus to Herod Antipas, who was in Jerusalem at the time, to observe the Passover. You know, let him handle it. Herod takes the opportunity to mock Jesus, demanding that he entertain him with a miracle performance. When Jesus refuses to accommodate him, he is viciously ridiculed and mocked, and Herod then sends him back to Pilate. Pilate yet again tries to avoid making a decision, takes the matter to the people, giving them a choice between Barabbas and Jesus. The custom during the Passover was to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd, and the crowd, as you know, chooses Barabbas, a zealot who had started an uprising. And when asked about Jesus, the crowd, worked up by the Jewish leaders, shout, "Crucify him." Upon this, his fate is sealed. He is then taken and flogged. He is stripped, put a scarlet robe around him. The soldiers twisted a crown from a vine of thorns, pressed it on his head, knelt in front of him in mock worship, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spat on him, struck him on the head multiple times. Though the exact route and distance is subject to some debate, the journey to Calvary was probably somewhere between a third to half a mile long. On the way, two noteworthy events occurred. A passerby named Simon, who had just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, was forced to carry the cross of Jesus. Most likely, in order to harmonize this with what John writes, Simon was probably carrying the cross beam of the cross while Jesus carried the pole. And secondly, a group of women mourned intensely for him, even wailing in bitter grief. Jesus arrives at Calvary, also referred to as Golgotha, or the place of the skull. His hands and feet are then nailed to the cross, and the cross is elevated into place. And this would be around 9 o'clock in the morning. And during the next 6 hours of the crucifixion, these final hours of his life, a number of noteworthy things happen. The two thieves who are crucified with him argue about who he is. The Jews argue with Pilate about what the inscription on the cross should say. A number of spectators lash out against him with mocking insults. The soldiers divide up his clothes and gamble for them. There is an unnatural darkness that fills the sky and the land. Jesus himself speaks at different times, commonly referred to as the last seven sayings of Jesus. His mother and a few other women, family and friends, stood nearby. He is offered a mix of wine and vinegar to quench his intense thirst, but he refuses to drink it. And finally, he says, "It is finished," and bows his head. Many who witnessed his last breath, we are told, responded with intense grief, beating their breasts. A Roman centurion standing at the foot of the cross proclaims, "Surely this was the Son of God." The earth shakes, the rocks split apart, the tombs of many holy people who had died were raised to life, and the veil in the temple protecting the Holy of Holies is mysteriously torn from top to bottom. A while later, a Roman soldier takes a spear and pierces it into the side of Jesus to make sure that he was dead, and out of his side came a sudden flow of blood and water. The body of Jesus is then taken down from the cross. The bodies of those who had been condemned by Rome and crucified for crimes of sedition or insurrection, like claiming to be a king, they were to be discarded, left out in the open for vultures and dogs to eat. However, Joseph of Arimathea, a rich man who himself was a member of the Sanhedrin, wanted to give Jesus a proper burial. So much so that he was bold enough to go to Pilate and make that special request, and Pilate gave his consent. Joseph, along with another supporter of Jesus, the Pharisee Nicodemus, they take the body of Jesus, wrap it with spices and strips of linen, and this was simply an initial preparation for, because the Sabbath was starting to set in, and so they just had to do something quick there initially. It was common for a tomb to house a number of corpses, but in this case, Jesus is placed in a new tomb. He is the only one in there. We would attribute this to the wealth of Joseph of Arimathea. This tomb, we are told, was in a garden and was near the place where Jesus was crucified. A large stone was rolled in place to secure the entrance, and soldiers sealed it and stood guard. The Jews who had condemned Jesus were quite unhappy that Pilate had allowed Jesus to be buried in a tomb. They wanted everyone to see the body eaten and picked apart by the dogs and vultures. They were aware of his claims to rise again and feared that his followers would steal the body of Jesus in order to fabricate and promote such a story. And they approached Pilate, and he agreed to let soldiers guard the tomb, but it is unclear how many and whether they are Roman soldiers or temple soldiers. This brings us to Saturday. Nothing much happens on Saturday, at least nothing we are told of. We can imagine a wave of euphoria sweeping over many of the Jewish authorities and perhaps a number of private parties throughout Jerusalem celebrating the end of Jesus. We did it. It is over. He is dead. He is buried. Not so much with the disciples of Jesus and his followers. It is quite a gloomy day for them. There's confusion, there's despair, there are doubts. This is a what do we do now kind of day for them. And now for Sunday, which is best presented directly from one of the original accounts of it. When the Sabbath is over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint the body of Jesus, complete what Joseph and Nicodemus had started. So picking it up here with these words, very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. And they entered the tomb. They saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So there you have it. That's kind of a abbreviated version of the greatest drama ever staged. There's a lot of more details to that we didn't get into. God the Son, this is what's needs to be cemented in our minds. He did not suffer. He did not die. He did not rise in some remote and mythical place, in some remote and mythical period of prehistory. It all takes place in real history, in a real place, with real people. There were witnesses. There are records. Jesus appears to the disciples, and for the next 40 days appears to many others. And then he ascends into heaven, promising to return. And this is the account of Christ's life. This is the gospel story. And it And it seems that the most fitting way to conclude is with the words from the Apostle John found near the end of his account about the life of Christ. John writes, "Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." Amen. That by believing you may have life in his name. So Dave, I'll turn it over to you at this time. Next Sunday we have Resurrection Sunday, and most likely we will continue the theme here, taking a closer look at the events and details of what happened on Sunday itself. And we'll be, if we do that, we'll probably be using Matthew's account. So let's go ahead and stand at this time, and we'll close with this song.